Head on Fire is a Patreon-supported podcast. Supporters of the show get early access to audio and video content, episode archives, monthly roundtables, a book club, and more. All benefits are offered on a sliding scale, so no matter your level of donation, you never miss out. If you like this show, consider supporting it with a dollar a month or whatever you can at patreon.com/headonfirepod. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Would you make a good cult leader? You had to have thought about this at some point, right? And if not you, then certainly somebody you know would make a great cult leader. You can probably picture them right now, right? What kind of cult would they have? Would it be a lot of white robes? Would there be a lot of color? Would it be naked in a jungle somewhere? Would there be crystals and chanting and weird teas? Would it be political, apolitical, conspiratorial? We are fascinated by cults. Every time I turn on one of my streaming services, there is yet another documentary about a cult somewhere. We like them. We're intrigued by them. There's podcasts about them and books and all sorts of stuff. And my guest today actually investigates them. My guest today has investigated folks like Teal Swan and the Fellowship of Friends and a host of other cult leaders and conspiracy theorists and strange internet rabbit holes that all suck people in and promise them a better life, or at least promise to take all of their money, or time, or effort, or energy, or solve some problem that they have, or maybe a problem that they don't, maybe a problem that the cult leader invented and told them that they have. Jennings Brown may not be a name you know, but you probably know his work. He's a journalist, editor, and podcaster based in Brooklyn, New York. He's also the host and executive producer of the podcast Revelations, which was about the Fellowship of Friends. He served as developmental executive producer of the Deep End docuseries that's appeared on Freeform and Hulu. He was also the senior reporter at Gizmodo, where he hosted the podcast The Gateway, which was about Teal Swan. Before that, he was an editor at Esquire and Popular Mechanics, among other publications. And his writing has appeared in New York Magazine, The Daily Beast, CNN, and Deadspin. He's an investigative journalist with a penchant for cults and cult leaders, and he's my guest today. Jennings Brown, thank you so much for being here on Head on Fire. Appreciate you coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. So for folks that don't know you or your work by name, probably because your work kind of lives on in different names in different areas, tell folks a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do.
Yeah, I am an investigative reporter. I report on all sorts of things, spiritual organizations, subcultures, strange crimes, dark corners of the internet. I don't know. I have a lot of curiosities and just see where they take me. And sometimes they take me into interesting situations. And so a few of my investigations have come out as podcasts. The first one was The Gateway, Teal Swan, about the spiritual guru Teal Swan. And then recently I released Revelations, which was kind of followed my 3 years of reporting into the organization called the Fellowship of Friends.
What is it about these kinds of organizations? I hesitate to call them cults. I know that you said you're not exactly like specifically a cult expert or something like that, but you do seem to get you do seem to have a name as somebody that investigates cults and cult-like entities. What about these fascinates you so much?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm not that into, you know, the so-called cult genre or true crime or serial killers or all of that. Like I don't really listen to those kind of podcasts. Like that doesn't interest me. But Teal Swan, I sort of fell into by accident. Again, I was reporting on strange subcultures and dark corners of the internet. Like I said, at the time, it was like the 2016 election. Mm-hmm. Or leading up to it. And I was kind of reporting on conspiracy theories and like InfoWars world and also a lot of like spiritual beliefs and how they were kind of spreading online. And, you know, darker stuff like sanctioned suicide forums where, you know, people post about, you know, how they want to kill themselves. And I hope there's a trigger warning before all this, because there's going to be probably some dark topics here. But at that time, you know, I was watching a lot of strange YouTube videos, and YouTube started recommending I watch videos from this woman who was staring deep into the screen and kind of had this hypnotic voice and the swirly backgrounds. But yeah, I just keep seeing her pop up. And finally I was like, what the hell is this? So I clicked it and was just like immediately pulled into it. I was like, this woman is doing something unique and fascinating. And I thought there was kind of a tech story there. Cause the time I was doing, yeah, it was the umbrella of tech reporting, because I would get bored with politics or business or culture, and tech sort of touches on all of that. But I was doing more esoteric sort of tech reporting than I think a lot of people do in that space. I done a story about like the online movement of Wiccans and pagans who were supporting Trump and, you know, things like that. I was kind of trying to find kind of niche, weird things. So I think I fit the sort of the algorithmic profile of somebody who might be into Teal Swan because of my personal interest in journalistic curiosities and all that. So it started recommending I watch Teal Swan. I watched the video. I was transfixed. I fell down this rabbit hole. I pitched it to my editor at Gizmodo, like, hey, I think there's this story. She seemed to be building this new form of spirituality on the internet, and really was very good at targeting SEO, like using SEO and kind of algorithm hacking to target people who are very depressed, very isolated, and very online. Which now a lot of spiritual gurus and grifters, you know, have kind of figured out that system. But she was very early on. She had a video for everything, anything you'd ever be looking up, including most famously now. Well, not maybe most famously, but the thing that gets her a lot of heat is she had a video called "What to Do If You're Suicidal." I want to kill myself. What to do if you're suicidal. And at the time, like if you search that on YouTube and maybe Google, I'm not sure, but if you search that, that was the first thing that popped up because mm-hmm. it's such a taboo. People don't want to talk about that. So I was fascinated both like what she's doing as an entrepreneur and a budding spiritual leader. And also there was a lot of controversy and saying, yeah, I want to investigate like if she was causing more harm than good. Anyway, the deeper I got, the weirder it got. And we decided to do it as an investigative podcast. After that came out, somebody optioned it and developed it into the show The Deep End, which is now on Freeform in Hulu. But after that, I started getting so many more tips. I mean, it just started as kind of like a journalistic curiosity, but then some people heard that because it had a pretty wide audience and started sending me other groups that they wanted me to look into or interesting things going on. So I sort of started falling more into kind of cult-like groups and studying that and trying to understand it better and trying to understand belief and the common threads and the things from these groups that do work, that do bring people and, you know, bring goodness into their lives and trying to understand like that differentiate between the good and the bad. I like how these groups take you into these strange worlds. I like taking listeners or an audience into a strange world they're unfamiliar with, and that maybe make them question their own kind of deeply held notions. Teal's world, she's built this world that was just very stranger than fiction. Then the group I did after that, Fellowship of Friends, they are this very, very strange community. We can get deeper into that. But being on their compound, I felt like I was in a David Lynch film. I mean, it was just truly one of the strangest worlds I've been in, and some of the most fascinating, wonderful, and sometimes twisted people. So I do like that component of it. But really, it's just stories that kind of take me into unique places and make me sort of, again, question my own deeply held beliefs.
I have been talking to some friends just in different spiritual paradigms and not about this evolving discussion of online versus IRL spiritual movements and the ways that they are starting to become possibly two different things. I mean, you can call yourself a whatever, you know, I'm the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. We'll just, you know, use something that absolutely nobody can get offended by. The online Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster and the IRL Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster at this point seem to be almost two different movements. There's two different kinds of conversations, two different sets of, almost two different sets of beliefs and burning hot topics going on. Do you find, because obviously grifters have always been around, Is there a big difference between the way these folks are operating online and the way these folks operate in person?
Well, I think the internet just puts everything into hyperspeed and makes every, like, the, you know, you have the typical kind of lifespan of a dangerous cult in mm-hmm. the before time, you know, in the early days, you know, the 70s through 90s, you know, before the internet. Yeah, it, like, takes a while, you know, you have a street preacher who gets some people who kind of are getting into him. And, you know, then that sort of, maybe he's like, oh, maybe I do have the message, the way to save these. And then, you know, like, people rally behind, you know, they start raising money, they build a compound. I mean, it, you know, this thing can take like several years. And it was interesting. Yeah, the Fellowship of Friends is very much that type of group. Like, it was Robert Burton started in the 70s, and the montage of showing the building of a cult would be very fascinating, but like it would be the span of, you know, 10, 20 years before, maybe 30 years before it's really in its golden era. Whereas online, you know, somebody starts posting something that resonates with people or is different or unique, and like all of a sudden overnight they can go viral and have that validation, and then, you know, it validates their worst impulses, like, oh, I do have a way to, like, I have figured out this new thing, or I've unlocked something. And, you know, as before, like, these leaders would have to, you know, read the great esoteric works and kind of make their own version of it, because that's, I mean, a lot of these groups, they are taking like great teachings from the ages and kind of repackaging them in a way that's more modernized. And I think there's a value to that, because, you know, a lot of the great works and the great teachings are due for an update. I'm sure you've tried to read, you know, a lot of, you know, old, you know, pagan texts, and it's just like, sure. You know, you're like, this would be better as a meme. Yeah. But yeah, so you have the, you know, people like Thiel who, yeah, turn these things into memes and make it way easier to, and yeah, like, so that it's like cults gone viral, you know, it's just a completely different thing, but then it's like fascinating watching. So when I was first reporting on Thiel, she was very good at YouTube. And now she's just like exploding during, you know, what she's doing incredibly well with TikTok, because all the things that made her such a good YouTuber make her even better TikToker. And I mean, she's just going, like, I see her, people are posting her memes and videos all over the place. So it's been interesting watching that, because I was in the thick of it in 2018. And now during COVID, she thrived with, you know, like, people are even more isolated and online finding her. And then with the Deep End came out, it's introducing her to a whole new audience. So now TikTok, there's like people choosing either side of, like, if they're kind of team Thiel or team the production company that made this documentary. And there's like, I'm starting to see like conspiracy theories get into it, and it's kind of evolving into the world of that kind of conspirituality, just weirdness, where it's like the leaders, I think the difference here is the leaders sort of lose control of where things are going. The algorithm sort of takes over and it goes to somewhere weirder and sometimes more sinister.
Why do you think these people choose spirituality as a guise to do harm? Do you think that folks like Thiel Swan, people that come to, that build up these spiritual cults? I mean, obviously there's lots of different kinds of, you know, organized, cults. I guess I'll just keep using the term because I can't think of another one.
Sure. I usually use sex, but that sounds like, sure, sex, you know.
Yeah.
Or you know, spiritual that, organizations. Yeah, because with Thiel, not many people had called her a cult, and I don't want to be the first, because I don't know, and I still don't know if, sure, she has a cult. I think it's something almost entirely different. The Fellowship of Friends has been called a cult by many, mm-hmm, experts before, so that's a little safer. But yeah, it's a load, you know, and cults didn't used to be, it was a new religious movement. I mean, Jesus, sure, was, you know, maybe a cult leader by certain definitions.
Well, I mean, you think back on, you know, the cult of Dionysus in ancient, yeah, Greece. I mean, that's just people that worship, yeah, Dionysus. It's just the, you, yeah, know, it did not have this malicious tone to, right, it. So I don't quite know what term I should be using, but obviously there's,
anyway,
different kinds of these addictive groups that don't necessarily, you know, use spirituality. So, but what about spirituality, you know, claims of the paranormal, you know, healing modalities, all of that kind of thing. What about that is so appealing to the prospective leader?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like most of the spiritual leaders I've gotten acquainted with or have reported on, I think they really do believe they're bringing they're doing what good. Like they're
really,
I think they believe in, like, I don't think Teal Swan, I think she really thought she was helping people and thinks she's helping people. I don't think she went into it trying to be a grifter. I mean, she's very open about the fact that she wants to be bigger than the Pope. I mean, incredibly famous. She's always, I mean, she's, you know, never hid those intentions, but I think it is both. I think it's coming from a place that she thinks that she's helping. And yeah, Robert Burton with the Fellowship of Friends, it seemed like he really believed it early on. And then like it just being surrounded by everything he wanted could kind of corrupted him. And he was a very damaged person. I don't know. It's hard to get in the psychology of why people do this, but I have done stories on like just complete grifters that I know that sure. I mean, like they know they're conning people, and there's a difference there. But spirituality, I guess, to answer your question, I don't know. It's like once you can convince people that you have some sort of esoteric knowledge that they don't, like you're closer to some divinity, some source of power, knowledge. Like if you can convince them of that, then you can pretty much convince them of anything. So it's a really easy way. I mean, it was very clever for Trump to really use religion in his own twisted way. I mean, once it's like it's power of good versus evil. I mean, that's deeply, I don't know, that speaks to something in all of us. It's a part of the brain that I think is easy to hack.
There's a phrase that our mutual friend Carrie Poppy uses that I really like, open-eyed and closed-eyed. Grifters. The open-eyed grifter knows that they're a grifter. They know that what they're doing is a grift. They know that the reason why they say things in certain ways or perform certain feats or something like that is all to support the grift. They know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. The closed-eyed grifter doesn't know that what they're doing is necessarily a grift. There's somebody that has copied Barnum statements. You see, I see a low grade version of this also on, you know, short form social media like TikTok and Instagram and stuff like that, where, people will take a deck of tarot cards and they're sitting there just throwing the tarot card, and you come on their video and they're throwing tarot cards and they pull one out and they say something like, you know, how are those attachment issues going for you?
Yeah.
And then buy my tarot services, that kind of thing. And, they're engaging in Barnum statements and these kinds of things, but they don't realize that what they're doing is throwing out a Barnum statement they're mimicking behaviors that they've seen other people that they consider more successful, maybe even other people that they considered a teacher, authors that they like, spiritual leaders that they like. In your experience, when investigating these types of groups, do you find more open-eyed or closed-eyed actors?
Yeah, that's a much more succinct way to say what I was just trying to hit with my rambling digression. Kudos to Carrie Poppy for that.
all kudos always go to Carrie Poppy.
Yeah. I think the stories that I've dived deeper into are the closed-eyed, because I think there's more I'm more fascinated, there's more nuance there, and you're like, where does the line between like transgressor and victim fall, like, you know, because there's other people that are kind of pulled into it, and they believe it, they're bought in. But the ones where it's like the open-eyed grifters, those I think I end up, because sometimes I'm like, all right, is this like a deep podcast or feature or just a quick story where I need to kind of put the word out? And the closed-eyed grifters are often the shorter stories, or the open-eyed grifters, because it's just like, all right, here's the con. Like, I'm putting it out there. People need to know, here's the con. Like, I'm trying to bring awareness to this. But yeah, so I think it's half and half. But, you know, when I was at Gizmodo, I had to do like 2-3 stories a day. And I was just always looking for the internet, like looking, you know, and so there's like scam subreddits and you know, where people are MLM, and I was like always looking for stories there and other places, and I did a lot of those kind of stories, but yeah, they're ultimately not as interesting to me, because it's just kind of like open and shut. This is how they're conning people.
is there something that that you think is universally appealing to people that end up going down these rabbit holes? Is it fear? Is it grief? Is it, you know, are they looking for something? I mean, some of these people, you talk to them and it's like, no, my life was going great. And then I found Jebediah Bullfrog over here, and Jebediah made my life even better. Like, you know, I'm thinking of Scientology and, you know, going after celebrities that already seem to at least be somewhat happy and taking them to even higher heights or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think anybody is susceptible to a cult-like group. I mean, it's really just like what works for you. I mean, sorry, I'm going to keep using these two comparisons.
Sure.
They're, you know, Teal Swan and the Fellowship of Friends are the ones I've spent the most with, and they really are in two different sides of the spectrum. Teal targets people who are depressed, isolated, alone, like desperate. She's very open about that. The Fellowship of Friends, it's seen as a cult of refinement. I mean, it's a lot of lawyers and doctors and business people, and they... with them, it's, they believe that in order to achieve enlightenment, you have to surround yourself with all the finest things in life, which is like, they have an incredible vineyard. They make their own wine. It's award-winning wine. They bring in opera and ballet and Shakespeare, and they're surrounded by Renaissance art. They have 44 angels that oversee them. It's Shakespeare, Rembrandt, Da Vinci, Bach, like all these, you know,
and only one woman, right?
Yes.
And one woman.
Yeah. which is Queen Elizabeth the first, because I'm sure if we just like leave people hanging, they're gonna be like, who is the woman? But yeah, so that's a group. It's like everybody there was like, yeah, I had everything I wanted in life. I was, you know, I took over my dad's company. I, you know, they were paying for my house, my hotel, I could go wherever I wanted, but like I was empty inside. I wanted something. I was looking for something more. And with the Fellowship of Friends, it was a lot of people who were very successful. It was often, I think, people who inherited money. So I think there might be an emptiness there, like kind of looking for your purpose. I don't know. I don't want to speculate too much, but there were patterns I saw that kind of similarities between people who joined, but two totally different groups between Teal and Fellowship of Friends. And, I think it's like a lot of, and that's Scientology. It's like, sometimes like people think it's like, it's when you're down and out that you get, you get conned. But a lot of times it's like, things are going so good. You're like, well, I'm on a roll. Like I'm going to get this lottery ticket. Like I'm going to go into this, sidewalk fortune teller and, you know, see what's next in my life. And then, you know, they seize on that. And, I don't know. I think it's just, the problem is when you're like, oh, I could never get into that. Like, I hate when people listen to so-called cult podcasts. Like, that could never happen to me. I'm like, no, like we all, there's something in us all that wants to believe in something higher or fears of our own mortality and wants something beyond that or just a deeper purpose. Cause like there has to be more. Like there has to be more than this, you know, us like just balls of meat talking through the internet, you know, me in a blanket fort, you know, it's there has to be something beyond that, right? So these people find a way to kind of hack into that desire to find those answers.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something there that people don't realize, that a lot of folks become very mistrusting if they start only hearing bad things. It's that, what is it? The Pollyanna principle, I believe, where if you, you know, hear negative things about yourself, or it's just a very realistic, very grounded thing that the cult leader or the street psychic or the whoever is telling you, you're less likely to believe it. You're less likely to believe that this person knows what they're talking about. So you have to pepper in those very positive, very uplifting things. People love to hear great things about themselves, right? You know, we want to hear that we are the most amazing person. People love taking personality tests. And I think it might surprise people to realize that folks tend to get picked up also on the upswing. Things are going really well. Tell me more great things about myself.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously like love bombing is a big component of this. Mm-hmm. And when I was I spent a lot of time in the Fellowship of Friends compound, with these, they have these amazing dinners and, you know, they have performances by Shakespeare, or they did put on performances of Shakespeare plays. Cause that's one of their angels. And, there were nights where I was like, One night in particular, I was about to go to see Shakespeare at their amphitheater they built. I was dressed up very nice for this sort of champagne jazz evening. And it was a lot of the high ranking members, and they kind of brought me into this. And we were in a garden next to the leader, Robert Burton's mansion. And there was fountains and the sun was setting and jazz was playing. And I was sitting at this table with all these like very intellectual people from all different kind of walks of life, you know, again, doctors and lawyers and artists and actors. And they were just so deeply fascinated in me. And everything I said was so funny. And, you know, they were making deep eye contact. I'm like, oh, we keep forgetting you're not a student. It's like, you're one of us. And I just being in this just totally separate, very romantic, enchanting world. And, you know, all these like successful people that seem like they have it figured out, just giving me so much love and attention and like offering to, you know, take me to these dinners and these events. I got sucked into that. And there was a difference. Like when I started reporting on Teal Swan, I was between jobs and I was dealing with a breakup, and I was and just getting a lot of targeted online hate for like reporting on right-wing extremism. And I was in a bad place. And when I was reporting on the Fellowship of Friends, I was in a much better place in life. Like I was doing what I love, like working independently, doing this podcast and like surrounded by all these other successful people kind of love bombing me. And yeah, I was like, thank God I knew all the bad stuff going into it, because this totally speaks to me. And I was like a theater kid growing up. Like I love the arts. I, you know, and so this group in this beautiful place where it's like worshiping. I mean, yeah, like you could convince me that Shakespeare is on some higher level. I mean, I read Shakespeare as a kid. Like, absolutely. I fuck with that messaging. Like, I could get into that. So, yeah, it was just kind of fascinating seeing that it was working on me a little.
I am curious, because you have written extensively, you've reported extensively on right-wing cults and sort of these internet scams and paranoia spirals and things like that, QAnon, plandemic, conspiracy theorists of all types, even like some multi-level marketing schemes, I feel like also share some of these commonalities. What's been your reporting like in those worlds? What are some of the hallmarks of those? What should we be looking out for? How do they differ from these more spiritual cult leader type groups?
Yeah, it's, you know, I had to get a little out of that because it was not good for my mental health. Like I said, it was 2016. I was in the thick of it. And I did a story about the guy who kind of became the face of Pizzagate. He was like the main YouTube, like all of his videos just blew up once like Pizzagate became a thing. And he was, I think, a mixture of a grifter who once just got that validation, like leaned more and more into it. And I just sort of was watching this man's, I think, mental health decline. And I'm not going to say his name because he's kind of like Voldemort for me. After I did that story, he started focusing his YouTube videos on me and making threats. And I just started getting all these, like, I was getting like calls and messages just nonstop, making threats. So that, and then he ultimately ended up suing me. That was the period I mentioned when like I started seeing these Teal Swan videos about suicide, you know. It was fascinating watching these people who, like, you know, they started as something, oh, here's an interesting thing. Like, I'm looking through these Podesta emails and like things, and then, you know, they start posting like, this is interesting. And then they get all this validation because of the algorithm leading people there. And also, I think, you know, there were a lot more YouTube and social media wasn't policing the like Russian, you know, foreign agent trolls as much. So that was leading to a lot more traffic. So it validates them. And they're like, oh, maybe this shit really is real. And they fall deeper into that. I was deep in that world in the 2016. And after that, I was like, I got to get out. And I think that was the appeal of the spiritual world, honestly. It kind of, some of it seemed kind of, it was this vacuum from the what was going on in the culture wars and the politics. Like at the time, Teal Swan was just totally separate from all that. And then, you know, Fellowship of Friends, they literally just built their own world of rules and just didn't really consume outside media. And that was kind of refreshing. But then I think during COVID, Teal Swan leaned more and more into plandemic type stuff. I wasn't following her as closely throughout that, but just watching kind of the evolution of her TikToks and YouTube videos, the YouTubes, Yeah, I watching that evolution was interesting because now it's all sort of blending together. There's no escaping it. It's I fell apart from the original question, but it's bleeding together. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is there really a difference between the way these sort of non-spiritual cults of paranoia, I suppose, you know, a QAnon, the Planet of, like, is there a way that those movements operate that's fundamentally different in some kind of way? Than the, it sounds like what you're saying is that the, at least with the groups, the sects, we'll use that word, that are more spiritual based, it sounds like there's at least the element of escapism there, possibly.
Yeah, but it's all like a game. I mean, you know, there's been really smart articles talking, like, comparing like QAnon to kind of like an RPG, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like this, especially when we were isolated in, you know, like during COVID, like it's this fun game where you can like find the clues and put it all together. And that's kind of also what religion is like looking for messages in the ancient texts or the Bible, like what is, you know, please God, like give me a sign, you know, and finding it in a scripture. I think there's a part of that, and then I think there were some stories, or maybe one big story I read about, this woman had kind of lost her mom to QAnon until Wordle came out. And then she started just sharing her Wordle scores with her daughter. And it was just like, all she was looking for was a really compelling game, and QAnon provided that. But there's just enough, like, the QAnon stuff is incredibly religious. You know, you have like people, you hear these stories about like in churches, like pastors like are losing their congregation to QAnon. I mean, there's enough in there that it can either both be like, there's room for people who are deeply faithful and looking for answers and like faith-based answers in the messages of Q, or just it's like it truly is the secret like agent in the deep state. And that's very enticing. Like there's some guy that has a plan. There is a plan, and also just trusting a plan. I mean, that's like a threat in all religions. Just like,
well, it's nice to, we don't know what's going on. It's nice to know that Jebediah Bullfrog over there, he knows, he's got it going on. He's got a plan. I have no plan.
Right. I'm just freewheeling, and it's scary. And then the Fellowship of Friends, they said that everything is a play written by the 44 angels, and anything good, bad, it all, any harm, it's all a part of the play. And that's appealing.
Do they have any explanation whatsoever for human history pre any of these 44 angels existing?
I think there's a larger play written by the absolute. You know, there's the absolute.
Oh, okay.
44 angels.
Gotcha.
And those 44 are the ones who. So
there's a bigger play, and then there's other, and then there's the letter. Then this is lesser plays, and then those are the plays that we're. Gotcha.
Yeah, but here's, I guess, the question I have for you is: I got into reporting on this because I was a bit of a seeker. Like I was like, this is a way to get paid to like, kind of look into these questions and understand different spiritualities and see like what resonates with me and maybe find the good, pull the good and the bad. And like, the more I report on it, the more patterns I see and the more harm I see. And admittedly, mm-hmm. like I'm looking out, I end up kind of in the worst of it, but you know, you have a kind of a journalistic approach. You're looking for these answers. You're talking to all these experts. You're trying to understand different faiths. How does that not interfere with what you believe or diminish what you believe?
So I don't have any separation in my personal worldview or spiritual paradigm for science, facts, evidence-based beliefs, evidence-based interactions, observations, that is the word I was looking for. That is part and parcel of the way that I look at the world. I simply believe that, you know, the world as it is a sacred and beautiful, wonderful, you know, magical thing. Beyond that, I also have a background in criminal justice, and I have a deep, deep well of wanting to see justice and fairness, and realizing at the same time that those are man-made concepts that don't actually exist in nature. Justice and fairness are just things that we invented in our heads. So Terry Pratchett, I think, said it best in Hogfather when he said, you know, in order to believe in the big lies of truth and mercy and justice, we have to believe in little lies like things like Santa Claus and stuff like that. But the sheer notion that there is anything such as compassion or fairness or truth or honesty in the universe is itself a belief in something bigger and greater. So I simply think that people should be afforded the dignity of the truth. And if the truth is ghosts, if the truth is psychic phenomena, if the truth is all of that, then cool, great. Then the evidence will show that. Or, if somebody is acting in good faith, then that will make itself very apparent. But if somebody is a fraudulent actor, that will also be made apparent as well. And I think that the people that are paying their money or giving their time or energy should know the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great answer. I mean, that's a lot of people. Yeah, I don't want anybody to ever think that I'm like trying to make a cult buster, or and I feel like anybody who listens to my podcast sees that I really try to find the value and the harm. But yeah, I think really what I push for, I just wish there was more transparency in these groups. And
yeah, I've always approached it, especially once I kind of got online in my late teens, early 20s, and found the wider world of spiritual people, you see all sorts of claims, and they sound really attractive. Yeah. I'm summoning demons in my bedroom. I'm, communing with aliens in the field. But the more I tried some of these things, and the more I engage with these groups, I'm like, okay, so when you say that Beelzebub was in your living room, and that a hole opened up and you could see hell and yada yada, was it that Beelzebub was actually in your room, or was it as though Beelzebub was in your living room? Because those are two distinctly different things. And I feel like that distinction needs to be, I just would like to know the truth there.
Right.
Why are you trying to pick this apart? Well, because I did all the things you said and nothing happened. So I just kind of want to know, what happened? What happened for you when you say these things happened? What happened?
Right.
And so I, like you, I also just simply value honesty and transparency in what we say, because there are folks that, as much as we appreciate a good love bomb, there are people that are in some dark places. That are grieving or depressed or broke. Oh my gosh, just the number of people that are just simply broke and looking for any way out because they don't have a plan. Somebody else has a plan. And if you do this, if you pay me $500 that I know you don't have, I'll light this green candle and then you will get so much money. You're going to get so much money. And if the green candle didn't work, just pay me more money and I'll light a bigger candle.
Right, right. Yeah.
So I do want to back away from specifically, cults, because I know that you're not some academic expert on cults. You're an investigative journalist. So I do want to talk about simply the function of being a journalist in 2022. Do you feel that the do you feel that the job of journalism, being a journalist, has changed since you started?
Absolutely. It's a weird time, but it's also good to remember, the sort of golden era of journalism didn't, last. It hadn't been very long since, total yellow journalism. Just there were right wing publications and socialist publications, and you didn't know what to trust. I don't know, a few decades where we were in a really safe spot where people trusted. There were very few institutions to journalism it's national journalism, and so there was a value in trusting. You want to be the most trusted man in America, or person in America.
Everybody wanted to be Walter Cronkite. There were
three national news sources, so it was the benefit to be the most trusted. Now there's a billion different networks, so it's just about speaking to people's personal truths, or finding what makes people the most engaged, and anger makes people the most engaged. Things have gotten very weird. Like I said, it was a dark time for me, reporting on just churning out these stories about the internet, which cybersecurity, Facebook, all the kind of creeping surveillance state stuff. And then not being able to step back and contextual, really be able to understand the bigger story and contextualize it. Wake up every morning and just check Twitter and see what the internet got mad about, and kind of think of stories to kind of to follow those threads and, you know, I guess to make people even more mad and more engaged. And it's a really vicious cycle. And it's not the journalist's fault, you know. I don't think any journalist got into, you know, be an arm of the deep state, or you know. And so, really, it really, really upsets me to see so much, you know, right wing and conservative hatred towards journalism, because, you know,
do you think it's only right wing and conservative? Because I gotta say, I look on my Twitter feed and I see the left seems to just. The left's favorite hobby seems to be tearing itself apart.
Yes. Yeah. Well, everybody hates, but I feel like it really started in earnest during like Trump era.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, where like I went from getting kind of like the occasional troll to just horrific death threats. And you know, I had colleagues who were sent bombs, you know, at CNN. Like it was a whole different era that and the language that these trolls and, you know, terrorists were using were coming from stuff that Trump had originated. And then hearing my Texas family use some of those same words just kind of to dismiss journalism, it was just really, it was painful, you know, to see, like, you know, I love my family but you know, they're Texas is more conservative, I think, than my values and you know, a lot more Fox News, and just to see that kind of dismissal in the language that was linked with people who are trying to kill people in my industry just for like getting into a job and wanting to sort of speak truth to power was really sad. But so I think that's one component of it. But I also think that there are a lot of these issues and the crumbling of like kind of regional and local news, because it's not sustainable, has made it so that you only have news organizations in major cities and coastal cities. And that leads to a huge just separation of like, there's an elitism there, and there's just a lack of understanding of the plights of people in the majority of the country. And so I think a lot of people are like, that's leading to issues in journalism and how in reporting that I think also a lot of other sort of elite leftists are disappointed in. And I don't know. There's just a lot of infighting. I don't know. I have a lot of thoughts that I haven't really learned how to compress into a nice soundbite, but I am just really, that's what's why I've enjoyed kind of stepping back and doing more of these podcasts where I can for investigations where I can focus on one story for several months or years, because yeah, it's pretty freaky.
Has your perception of journalism as a field changed? The way that you do your job, the way that you feel that journalists do their job now, has that fundamentally shifted?
Yeah, I started, in magazine. I wanted to be a magazine editor. I wanted to do, I guess, more what I was doing now. Like, I saw magazines. This was like, you know, going to college in the you know, early 2000s, I guess. Graduated 2008, and at that time, yeah, I mean, it was like the seemed like the place to do like in-depth feature writing, to have the resources to really be thoughtful about a story that can make a big impact, was magazines. So I went there and ultimately ended up at Esquire magazine, where I thought that's, you know, they were doing really thoughtful, in-depth stuff, but it was just seeing their resources just diminish and kind of doing less of that and more kind of more fluff and more style. And it is just kind of disappointing to see this institution kind of crumble. So I need to go to the internet. I have to figure out, I didn't want to be a total dinosaur. So I started going to online sites. That made me sound like a dinosaur. I started going to online news, you know, organizations, and ultimately I ended up at Gizmodo, where I was just then I there we, you I was able to do some more, like I was able to do the gateway there, but I still had to like churn out two or three stories a day. I mean, that was the expectation. I never made it, but I got to a place where I can really be thoughtful in this one story about Teal Swan and how she's evolving, but at the same time I was doing just these kind of not clickbaity, but you know, grabby, voicey stories about, you know, how Facebook is giving us brainworms. And it was kind of fun to be voicey there, but it was like, I mean, Gizmodo has always kind of been kind of the punk publication of in the tech world. Just like their sister publication Deadspin was always kind of like the punk publication in the sports world, you know, just like, they're like, we're not worried about access or getting all the tech early on. Like, we're just going to tell you like what you really need to worry about in a way that sounds conversational. But you know, you were like kind of poking the bear with a lot of the headlines. And then what I think a lot of people don't realize is I might put a lot of thought into an article, but the headline is usually written by an editor and kind of workshopped by other editors. Like what's going to grab people. And then it's given to a social media person or an intern or somebody who, you know, it's like they, because of their, I don't want to dunk on social media workers at all. I mean, they do the Lord's work and they get our stories out and they try to be as thoughtful as possible, but they're often, everybody's overworked. You know, the fact that I should not be having to do like three stories a day while also making this deeper podcast and working on feature stories. Editors should not be having to churn these out, like have to do a quick edit in 5 minutes and slap a grabby headline. And then social media interns and staff should not have to, you know, like a minute to skim an article to post it online, you know, and everybody on the other side of the chain is like, come on, I gotta get the story out, you know? And it's like, there's, because everybody, you know, it's like, if you don't get up first, then you don't get, you know, the best SEO, the search engine optimization, you know, it's so separate from just writing a good story. But anyway, then like, so once the social media person like comes up with the version of the headline for Twitter, that might be completely different from the actual headline, which might be very different from the story. And 99.9% of people who think they read an article or see an article really is just like the social media headline, which is so far removed from the article. So that's just a very flawed system. And it incentivizes kind of rage clicks. Yeah, it's like the most visibility of journalism is that, which is so separate from the actual person who's putting all the thought and research into the article.
There is a difference between the perception of consumers of articles and books and nonfiction works, generally speaking, and the realities of the industry, in that fact-checking isn't really as abundant as I think people seem to think that it is. People think that if it comes out in a book, that it was thoroughly fact-checked. And that's simply not true across the industry. I'm curious, what is the relationship with this fast-paced 2-3 articles a day, plus features, plus podcasts, plus all of this other stuff? And not necessarily your specific work, but just your gauge of the industry as a whole. How stringent are publications about making sure that things are vetted and fact checked before they're put out there?
Oh yeah, that's terrible. Yeah, again, when I got into journalism doing more magazine work, and certainly not all of the magazines I worked at were like hardcore journalism. I mean, the first one was Cigar Aficionado, but I was trying to get into a place of, and Esquire was closer. You know, they published some incredible journalists and writers. But so we always had, and then before that, I was at Popular Mechanics, and we always had this like very thorough fact checking. And I love that. I would love, like, you sit in the cubicle with a fact checker who they're all like very distinct personalities. I worked with one fact checker who was a classically trained clown on the side. And he was incredible. Always had great quips, you know, but we just go line by line, like every sentence that contains a fact, they would verify it. Like, what was the weather like that day, all that, like it was truly incredible and felt like something of just, you know, a bygone era. And then I remember the first news site I worked at, I like, because usually with it before, you know, I'd give, anytime I was writing a story or I was working with because I was an editor and a writer, I would work with writers, I'd ask for their list of sources. So you hand over the list of sources to the fact checker and they go through it. But so I came up with a list of sources for my first article I wrote online at this site that's closed now called Vocative. And I told my editor, like, what do I do with these sources? And he was like, I don't know, embed them if you want, just like link to the sources to show your work. And this was the place where I was, I went from like writing one story over 3 months to like, yeah, churning out three stories that didn't have, you know, like proper fact check. There was no fact checker. And at Gizmodo, same story. For sensitive stories, we'd have a legal edit, but the fact checking kind of comes down to the editors who you're working with. But with the Gateway and Revelations, the podcasts I do, I want to make sure they're airtight and legally airtight. So I go through legal edits. We hired an independent fact checker, because it's ultimately, yeah, if I'm putting stuff out there that could influence a lot of people's lives, like everybody in the group or the leader, I want to make sure that there's nothing inaccurate in there. But yeah, that is sadly, I mean, even in the bigger institutions, New York Times, Washington Post, I've seen stories about how that's where they're cutting costs.
I mean, I remember asking my own editor in my own, you know, for my own book, I was like, hey, just out of morbid curiosity, like, what's the fact check like for my manuscript? Like, you know, I'm saying some stuff in here, like, what's that look like? And so she walked me through that. I was concerned about, you know, my own legitimacy. So I'm really curious, mostly because I just think that people still have this idea. I mean, I saw it, a memory on my phone this time last year, somebody was saying, you know, trust books from publishers because they have been vetted and fact checked. I'm like, they really have not.
No,
they just haven't. Nobody has these resources. I don't know who all of these fact checkers are that you think are getting hired, but that's simply just not true. So in that space, acknowledging that most of the articles that we read about probably most things on a daily basis haven't had that line by line fact check that I think we all think is happening, and editors sort of just trust that the journalist, the writer, the whoever did the work. How does the casual observer spot good and bad information?
Yeah. I mean, but it's also frustrating that people are like, oh, well, there's no fact checking, so I'm just going to find my own sources, and their own sources end up being like, you know, and it's like, there is a level of thought and concern. And with Washington Post or Gizmodo or any of the, like, they're seen as serious publications. Like they can be sued for libel or defamation. Like they are very careful. And if they get something wrong and somebody points it out, they issue a correction. Whereas a lot of the sort of conservative, like, grifter
blogs
type. Yeah, like those don't have any of that, so there is, like, I don't want to say, like, I want to be careful to say, like, it's not like it's all diminishing across the board, because
no, not at all.
I know you're,
I'm
not
just saying that it's industry-wide. I think just anytime you're talking about nonfiction works, books that are published, that kind of thing, there's just a problem with, there's just a lack of fact checking, just generally speaking. So then my question is, how does the casual reader, Are there any clues that I might need to go double check this?
No, we're all screwed. I think that, again, with these institutions, there is more, again, Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, like those newspapers, they have more than anywhere else. And they have more on the line, because despite what, you know, right wing bad faith actors will say, like there are people that do want some sort of objective sense of objective truth. And they got into it for, I think, many of them for the right reasons. Nobody got into journalism for money. And if they did, then they were sorely disappointed at first. I think it's just like unfortunately, it's like the all the things I can say kind of come with a position of privilege. Like I have writers who I trust, but that's because I'm in the industry and I have, like, it is my job to, like, look for sources. So I figured it out. It's hard to come up with tips that I could give people who are just, like, passively consuming news and media and are being bombarded by it. I don't know. Like, for me, it's sort of a smell test, but, like, I don't know how to, like, I don't know how to tell my, like, boomer family who have terrible media literacy, because, and it's not their fault. It's like, you know, there's all these, like, great publications that people are throwing a bunch of money into, and they're hiring up really great writers, but they don't look any different than Breitbart, or, you know, like, they all look kind of slick and the same. I don't know. I wish I had.
I think my favorite one out of all of them, especially in the last couple of years where we've all gone so online. I mean, it just, yeah. You know, we were online for a really long time, but since the pancetta, we have been very online. And I think my favorite one is misleading keywords. You know, I'm an award-winning actor, and
yeah,
the award was a Razzie. You know, like I don't think people realize that, like, we're the implication of the claim there and the truth of it are two very different things. That's my favorite red flag, I think.
Yeah, I wish if I had more time, I could probably come up with a list of. I mean, that's a really good one. And I am going to think about that because people ask me all the time, like, what can I trust? And yeah, it's like claims like that. And like when I was reporting Gizmodo, a lot of it, I was kind of doing weird esoteric stuff. I would link the hell out of everything. So I'm like, if I'm just making a claim, I would try to link to the source for that claim or the research. So I kind of let people see for themselves rather than, it's a lot of these news sites where they just make all these crazy claims. And there's no link to what, and if you try to look it up, like you can't find where the source is. Like that's a huge issue.
I want to be respectful of your time, so I know you have to go. I do want to ask you one final question. You've had a lot of experience in these worlds. If you were to create a cult, what would it be?
Oh, man. I think a lot about like cult style. And so first and foremost, I would want like the looks have to be fire.
Sure.
I don't know. I don't know if it's like a jumpsuit. You know, Heaven's Gate had great shoes. But
like, is it a jumpsuit, but it's like the deep V with like the platform? Yeah. Okay. I'm seeing it.
I think I want it very colorful. I think a lot of cults are very monotone. I want, you know, some sort of not like necessarily a rainbow. I don't want to signal that it's just like, you know,
it's the gay cult. We're loving that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But I want it to be bright and colorful and, you know, very, you're just like accepting of all. I don't know. It's like, what's the good cult? Like, I feel like no matter what, a cult needs a strong charismatic leader, right? Yeah. Like, it can't just be like, we all like the same type of dog. I think of that because I keep seeing your adorable fluff behind you. What's your dog's name?
This one is Kika. I have two dogs. Okay. She has recently become blind, so she's bumping around because she doesn't know how to find her way out of the room.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, like I would follow the cult of Kika. but yeah, it's like we can't just all be united in our love of a certain thing because eventually, like, we will go our certain ways. There will be infighting, and you kind of need like. I noticed that with the Fellowship of Friends, like whenever the conversations would lull at dinner, you know, people who'd been together forever, you know, they'd steer to Robert, the leader. Like, did you hear Robert, you know, was sick, or did you hear he spoke to Leonardo da Vinci last night? So I think that's what kind of keeps, you need that kind of uniting thing, like and then once the leader dies and it kind of maybe evolves into a religion, you're more united in that kind of moral code maybe, or the trauma bonding. I don't know, but as far as just like starting a cult that's going to flash off,
yeah,
it's like, I don't know, I feel like I'm afraid to go there because I feel like it's like it eventually
you have too much corrupts. You would be the minute it gets in your head, you'd have too much power, you'd be the best of cults.
Right.
Well, Jennings Brown, thank you so much for
the looks would be fire. Yeah.
You so much for spending some time here with me today. If folks want to connect with you, where can they do that?
Yeah, they can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at T Jennings Brown. You're also welcome to send me any tips or leads. That's where I get some of my best story ideas, or you can just email me at jenningsbrown@protonmail.com. Feel free to connect.
Well, thank you so much, sir. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. This was fun.
That is going to do it here for this episode of Head on Fire. My eternal gratitude to Jennings Brown. I hope that you all will go check out his work and listen to all the back episodes of his podcasts. plural. They're all great. If you like this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. Please share it with your friends on social media. It's free and it helps me. You can also like or rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And while you're there, consider leaving a review. Reviews help recommend the show to other listeners like you. You could also help keep the show free and producing regularly by joining my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes, a private Discord server, and a monthly book club. This month, we are still reading Bad Gays, because it is a very big book. Sign up at patreon.com/headonfirepod. If you'd like to connect with me on social media, I am at headonfirepod pretty much everywhere. Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. There is a Facebook, but it's not bad. Thank you all for downloading and streaming the show. I'm gonna head out, but before I do, remember, if you're being love-bombed in front of a mansion watching a play put on by the ghost of Shakespeare, it's probably a cult.